Welcome to the FT Money Fuller Tracy audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:19 Pacific Standard Time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. If you've been watching what we've been doing this week, then you'll see that we really have tried to focus on the industrial resources sector, and not least because so many of the shares have attracted investor interest over the last few weeks that they're coming off of very depressed levels. And I guess let's focus on exactly why that might be, and really what's been happening over the last decade and what we can expect over the next few years. Well, in the decade following China's devaluation of the yuan, there was a massive competitive advantage, and that really started to take shape from 2003 onwards, where the investment in massive infrastructure development was creating this supply inelastic environment meets rising demand that characterized the beginning of a massive bull market in commodities that translated into the commodity companies coming from a very slow start because they'd been conditioned over a long period of time not to expect too much from the industry, that it wasn't going to recover, that there was never going to be a demand-driven cycle similar to that they'd seen in the 1970s, and that there hadn't been any investment in new supply for well in excess of a decade. That left them in the position that they weren't able to increase the supply of key commodities when Chinese demand and emerging market demand really started to pick up. Well, China's devaluation helped it along in terms of its competitiveness, and the Asian financial crisis resulted in a large number of the Asian countries having endured a number of years of really rather difficult trading environments, coming through with low debt levels and the conditions set for the growth of the middle class. Now, the growth of the middle class is still very much in action, and we're continuing to see hundreds of millions of people rising out of poverty and into the middle classes across Asia. And the chances are that in the next couple of decades, we're going to see even more people lifted out of poverty and into the middle classes around the rest of the world, not least in the Middle East and Africa. And that represents a considerable growth opportunity. Those regions are probably going to probably not resemble Asia in the same respect that we've seen just one after another country in Asia rising from deeply poor levels to middle-income countries, and a number moving into high-income countries, the high-income country bracket. Well, the Middle East is in one respect hampered by the fact that there's so much oil sloshing around, which removes the competitive spirit. But nonetheless, you do have the demographic dividend there. And the Arab Spring highlighted nothing other than the fact that people want a better standard of living, and they are willing to do what is necessary to achieve it. So that would suggest that the Middle East is going to develop further in terms of the growth of the middle class and improving the standard of living for its millions of very young people. And Africa is coming off a very, very low base. So when you think about the drivers for demand growth in future, then they're certainly there. But when we go back and look at what China has done, then it has world-class infrastructure now in terms of transport. So it has world-class airports, railway stations, high-speed railways, and a pretty comprehensive freeway network. So the benefit that China can reap from building additional infrastructure will be much more dependent on how well that is going to improve the human capital of the economy. So the growth of the services sector is something that is likely to be much greater in terms of the country's growth drivers in future. The healthcare sector, the environmental sector, transport in so far as it relates to underground systems or rapid transit within cities, and of course the rollout of additional civil engineering works such as sewage. But the demand growth forecasts in terms of commodities that helped to spur massive investment in the period up to the credit crisis haven't really been realized, and they're unlikely to be realized since China is moving through this period of rationalization. But considering just how far it's these commodity-related sectors have fallen, a good part of that is already in the price. And there is a large swathe of the industrial mining sector that is more than 50% off its peak, and a somewhat smaller number that is even more has experienced even greater declines. There's a good portion of the gold mining sector that is 90% off its peak. So we can conclude that there is a lot of the bad news already in the price, not least because so many of these miners have been writing down what were rash or ill-advised decisions to massively increase supply or to pay over the odds for less than world-class assets. And a large part of that has already taken place. A lot of the write-downs have already taken place. What we're also seeing is that because of the rationalization in the industry and the fact that availability of credit to the commodity complex was pretty much removed or evaporated during the credit crisis, that the sector has become less attractive to from the perspective of institutional investors, and not least the banks themselves. So what we've seen in the last year has been that a considerable number of the investment banks have been selling warehouses, they've been selling trading operations, and they've been closing their research desks and closing their sales desks. Well, part of the reason for that is because they are cautious about the type of legislation that's going to come down, or the regulation that's going to come down from the CFTC. But what that is also starting to translate into is that it's removed the speculative element from the market, and that the liquidation of some of those positions will have been a weight on the market over the last year. And the fact that now we're getting to the end of that process, the fact that the rationalizations are over, or at least the write-downs of some of these very large purchases have taken place, has resulted in a large number of the commodities losing downward momentum and entering these ranging phases, and now we're starting to see breakouts. The tightness that had developed in the market because of those rationalizations, because the price had declined back to the marginal cost of production in a large number of cases. And if you look over the last 30 and 40 years where there's data available, this is still reasonably high prices for, on a historical basis, for the majority of commodities. So we've had another step up in the marginal cost of production. And that's generally the result of any major bull market in terms of the commodity complex. It was exactly the same with the oil price. And if you look in the chart library, you'll find a chart. The ticker is OILPHIST. It's the historic oil price, and it goes back to the 1900s. And if you look at that on a log scale, you'll see that it has a step sequence advance, so that prices don't generally tend to go back down to the levels that prevailed before the bull market started. And even in the case of natural gas, where there has been a phenomenal supply response to high prices, and not least in other areas of the energy complex, well, prices got back down to a little bit less than $2 briefly, and are currently in the region of $6 as a result of the very cold weather, further illustrating just how tight the market had become. But prior to the bull market starting, natural gas generally traded around $1. So even in the case where you've had the greatest supply response, you haven't had prices come back down to where they had traded previously. And that helps to illustrate how we have defined the peak oil or peak commodity argument over the last decade, in that it is best defined in terms of the rising cost of marginal production. We're not going to run out of commodities, we're not going to run out of oil or natural gas, certainly not natural gas, but the price at which we can get it out of the ground is going to increase. When we think about how this move that is currently unfolding in some of the commodity complex is can be characterized relative to the wider market, well, this week we've seen that Wall Street has continued to advance, and we're seeing a tiny bit of profit taking at the end of the week, so that the main US indices finished down very, very slightly. But we've seen that a short-term oversold condition has turned into a short-term overbought condition. The short-term oversold condition was a trend in consistency relative to what it had seen, what we've seen previously, and the Nasdaq has pushed on to new high ground. It's a little bit overbought at the, in the short term, but for anyone who's still holding long positions, they haven't experienced any profit erosion. There's nobody really worried about this market, and people are continuing to look at the macro environment and thinking that Fed tapering is going to last at least into September, that there's a new Fed governor who is perhaps even more dovish than the previous Fed governor, and that if the economy does weaken, that she will reopen the taps. So one of the reasons that people have this sense of complacency is that the correlation between the size of the Fed's balance sheet and the performance of the stock market has become increasingly powerful over the last 18 months, so that if one wanted to perform in line with the market or to hope to outperform the market, then one really would have had to look at the Fed balance sheet and conclude that as long as it is increasing, that there is no reason to sell. In other words, accepting the fact that this is a liquidity-fueled rally. Well, we're still in a very liquid environment. The Fed tapering is a beginning of a lengthy process of normalization of monetary policy. We've never been through this type of environment before, but what we have seen is that while the Fed is controlling the short end of the curve, that the long end of the curve has responded, so that yields surged in the middle of last year, and we're now appear to be in the first step above the base, and that this ranging phase could be potentially lengthy, but that the low in yields is in. Well, when we think about how bull markets generally progress, you generally tend to see that the peak happens in the bond market first, and we're still arguing as to whether the peak is in the bond markets, but it really is worth looking at the total return on US treasuries. And for a market that had been the most consistent trend in the world, and that's not an exaggeration, the total return on 10-year treasuries had only gone up for 32 years. And when you look at that on a PNF point and figure chart, it is just an unbroken succession of just a straight line higher. Found support in the region of the 200-day moving average on successive occasions. Well, it lost momentum from 2011 onwards. It broke below the 200-day moving average, and it spent more time below the moving average than at any time in the course of the bull market. Well, that those are massive inconsistencies. And for a trend that was previously the most consistent trend in the world. So there is still an argument, because people haven't really experienced any profit erosion. But when one looks at the chart, then the odds are that the peak is in, that the bull market is over, and that really what we're in right now is potentially a first step below the top. Well, that's likely to have quite profound knock-on effects for just about everything. It hasn't been since the late 1950s that equities yielded more than bonds. And back then, it was because investors felt like they needed to be compensated for the additional risk they were taking on in the corporate sector. Well, on this occasion, the chances are that they're going to have to be compensated for the additional risk they're taking on in the bond sector. Corporate bond funds have to manage their duration, which means that they are always selling bonds. It means there's no yield to maturity. In other words, what they've depended on in the last 5 years particularly has been capital appreciation. And if we're correct in concluding that the low is in terms of yields, then that removes the guarantee of capital appreciation from the bond markets. And it means that people will have to start demanding a higher yield in order to compensate them for the loss of pretty much what has been a guarantee of capital appreciation due to quantitative easing. When we look at asset classes, then it is in the equity markets that you have the potential for dividend growth outstripping not just inflation, but also the yield on either corporate or government bonds. And the stock market has completed a 12-year range. So we've been rallying now for 4 years, and we've had a peak in government bond prices. And what we've also seen is that there's been a little bit of a loss of consistency in some of the leading indices, but no conclusive topping activity. But what we are now seeing is that cyclical sectors are beginning to move to outperformance, and it is not at all unusual that we see powerful rallies taking place in cyclical stock market sectors, such as the mining sector and potentially the oil sector, in the latter stages of cyclical bull markets. So there is the potential that we're going to see people looking additionally for value in this market. Well, on a PE basis, the mining sector is low. A lot of the bad news is already in there. We've already seen that the Middle Eastern markets have been outperforming for the last 6 months. In terms of the emerging markets, you don't have the kind of currency risk in the Middle East that you have in a number of other regions. And that is beginning to be reflected in additional investor interest for those stock markets. But they were generally cheap. They had been in a pretty depressed state for a number of years. So what people are now looking around for are those assets that haven't yet had substantial moves to the upside. But generally speaking, when one is looking and casting around for things that are cheap, then that isn't a particularly bullish signal for just how long the bull market is likely to continue to last for. When we look at cyclical outperformance, then the fact that you're seeing the spread between WTI and Brent crudes tighten up, that's certainly being helped by the fact that the southern portion of the Keystone Pipeline has already opened. And it's removing the supply glut in the Cushing facility in Oklahoma. What we can anticipate is that that spread will continue to narrow as distillate exports continue to increase from the USA. But it does result in prices moving a bit higher than might be comfortable, with WTI now above $100 and closing out the week at 102.25. It would be an uncomfortable situation if Brent crude moved above $120. It's still very much within its range, and it was a little bit weaker in the last 2 days, suggesting that the upside pressure is more on WTI than on Brent. But the issues that we have are, there's a historic issue with high oil prices leading to recessions, so that is certainly worth watching. Over the medium term, there's every likelihood that we're going to see energy prices trending lower on an inflation-adjusted basis. But the risks do remain to the upside in the short term. At the Singapore seminar last week, what people were most worried about was the currency markets. And following the Nasdaq crash and the credit crisis crash, we've often said that there's no country wants a strong currency, but some countries need a weaker currency more than others. Well, the USA needed a weaker currency more than others, and the US dollar went through a decade-long decline, and particularly against some of the stronger currencies, not least in commodity exporters or currencies like the Singapore dollar. The Brazilian real, for example, doubled against the US dollar between 2001 and 2007. So really, when we ask the question, is how likely is that to persist when the USA is leading the global economy out of a very difficult period, and with Europe also moving onto a recovery trajectory, the likelihood of the US dollar weakening significantly against other currencies is unlikely at this stage. Well, investors poured a great deal of money out of the US and into emerging markets in order to escape the volatility of their domestic market and the weakness of their respective currency, and they were encouraged by the fact that economic growth was picking up in the Asian region, and they were getting currency market and capital market appreciation. Well, if the US dollar is bottoming, well, that necessarily means that other currencies are topping out. And if you have been used over the last 10 years to getting currency market and capital market appreciation, well, then that's a significant development. It suggests that we're going to have significantly more volatility in the emerging markets as people pay much more attention to the value of their respective currencies. Well, we've had some weakness in, and there hasn't been a great deal of commonality. So the Taiwan dollar remains in a downtrend, and the Taiwan stock market remains in an uptrend. It's certainly helping that companies like Taiwan Semiconductor are getting a bit more competitive, not least against their Japanese and Korean counterparts. The Singapore dollar, as a private banking center, remains a regional powerhouse, but it has been trending higher against the US dollar for 10 years, and that trend has lost momentum. It's unlikely to fall very far, but it's also unlikely to appreciate very much further than it already has. And I guess we have good examples in Asia of countries that have already experienced devaluations. And Vietnam, which posted a downside key reversal yesterday, now looks like it is going to enter a period of mean reversion following what has been a very impressive advance over the last couple of months. But it experienced its devaluation more than 2 years ago. And the reforms that were instituted concurrently have been very, very positive indeed for the wider market. When you look at China, then China has got a problem with bad loans in its banking sector. One of the reasons that you have the banking sector in China trading at single-digit multiples, where Bank of China has a PE of 4 and has a yield of over 6%, illustrates the fact that investors have very little confidence in the figures that the banks are putting out. So yes, they have high reserve ratios, but what they also have is a pretty opaque balance sheet, and people don't understand what the risk is, and since they don't understand what the risk is, they're unwilling to contribute capital. We need a catalyst to really start to reignite interest in the Chinese market. The IPO market is starting up again, I think next month, that will release additional supply into the market. It all depends on who is there to buy that supply and what kind of encouragement they're likely to get and what types of companies come to the market will really dictate how the stock market really responds to that. But the banking sector remains a very significant weighting in the index. And until we see some form of transparency in terms of bad loans and how that issue is going to be tackled, then it's probably going to be a rangy environment at best for the Chinese market, although we are at a very low level, so it's certainly not expensive. When we think about what the potential problems are in China, well then there have been some extraordinarily large figures bandied around, and a figure in the region of $4 trillion in terms of the corporate banking sector is potentially not unrealistic. Well, that's a very large number. And the Chinese have got a lot of money in reserve. They can move money from one side of the balance sheet to the other. Some of the debt can be forgiven. Some of the debt can be restructured. Contracts are infinitely renegotiable in China. And if all else fails, then the renminbi can be devalued. When we think about all of the currencies in the world that where governments have taken an activist role, and not least in Japan, and considering just how competitive the environment is becoming between China and Japan, and indeed with the rest of Asia, then how likely is China to allow the renminbi to continue to appreciate when just about all of its regional neighbors, and not least its the countries that it competes with for market share in the global economy, are actively managing the value of their own currencies? Well, China has unwound almost the complete devaluation of the currency from the early 1990s. And that's a significant level. The 6 yuan level to the US dollar is potentially a Rubicon. And we've seen this week that the renminbi has weakened. There is the next party congress beginning in March. And this is where a number of people are looking for the detail on what exactly the reform agenda is likely to be. But watch the currency. If we were to see a devaluation of the renminbi, it would certainly highlight the fact that the banking sector is under severe stress, but it would have a significant knock-on effect for the rest of Asia in particular. So when we think about what the risks are, then a rising oil price is certainly one of them, but a devaluation of the renminbi would have a significant knock-on effects for just about everything. In the meantime, the fact that gold shares are at their lowest levels relative to the gold price since 2001 would suggest that provided gold prices can hold above $1,200, and they're finishing out the week at $1,323, that a large amount of the bad news is already in there, and that there is a significant potential for appraisal of the sector, considering just how much write-down has already occurred. And that's a very similar story for a large swathe of the mining sector. We're even in the uranium sector, where we've seen a number of companies move to bankruptcy, that there are signs that some of the larger companies are completing bases and forming first steps above their bases, and that's really positive action. So that even if we recognize that this outperformance of cyclicals is a late in the cycle event, it doesn't remove the fact that it's going to be a significant money making opportunity. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, or the afternoon, and wish all the best to all of you.